Save big money on your outdoor project at Menards. We make landscaping simple with our free, easy-to-use design program and step-by-step project guides. Plus, Menards has the largest in-stock selection of concrete landscape block at the best prices. Save big on everything when you shop at Menards. Visit us in-store or on Menards.com to see our full selection of landscape blocks and get your outdoor project started today. Save big money
at Menards. Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hello, friends. Tis I, Duncan Trussell, and you are listening to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast. A lot of you guys got a little pissed at me because of my anti-war rant where I targeted Bernie Sanders and called him out for his support of Obama's expansion or continuation of the war in Afghanistan. A lot of folks felt like I was being dogmatic, and that when it comes to war and when it comes to the Middle East, we can't be dogmatic. There's no place for being dogmatic when it comes to war. There are shades, people say. There are shades where we have to take little steps in the direction of peace, and we can't expect it to all happen at once. So, in response to that, I just want to read some quotes that I found on the internet, some very dogmatic quotes, and then we'll move on and maybe never talk about war again, but I doubt it. But let's just read some of these great quotes. War is the greatest plague that can affect humanity. It destroys religions, it destroys states, it destroys families. Any scourge is preferable to it. Martin Luther. How vile and despicable war seems to me. I would rather be hacked to pieces than take part in such an abominable business. That's Albert Einstein. All forms of violence, especially war, are totally unacceptable as means to settle disputes between and among nations, groups, and persons. The Dalai Lama. I abhor war and view it as the greatest scourge of mankind. Thomas Jefferson. If there is one principle more deeply rooted in the mind of every American, it is that we should have nothing to do with conquest. Thomas Jefferson. Overgrown military establishments are under any form of government inauspicious to liberty and are to be regarded as particularly hostile to Republican liberty. George Washington. A highwayman is as much a robber when he plunders in a gang as when single. And a nation that makes an unjust war is only a great gang. Benjamin Franklin. The chain reaction of evil, wars producing more wars, must be broken, or we shall be plunged into the dark abyss of annihilation. Martin Luther King. Don't let them trick you into thinking there's shades of war. If there's anything in the world to be dogmatic about, it's war. Be dogmatic about war. In the past, I've fallen prey to the concept that military intervention in different parts of the world was somehow necessary, but the more I think about it and the older I get, the more it seems to be preposterous, ridiculous, and absurd. It's not me being naive. It's me trying to rise above the awful corporate propaganda that gets sprayed into our eyeballs on a daily basis by the mainstream media. Sorry if I'm turning into Alex Jones here for a second. I'm sure you'll forgive me. You can be dogmatic about war. You're allowed to be dogmatic in certain situations. If you want to be, you can be dogmatic about war. There are things in the world that you're allowed to be dogmatic about. One of them, I think that we can all agree on, is that you can be dogmatic about this simple truth. It's always wrong to fuck a kid. No one's ever going to argue with you on that. And if they do, they're fucked up. And keep them away from your kids. Always wrong. Never right. You can build a philosophy on that. It's always wrong. Why is it wrong? It's wrong because kids are innocent. Kids have not developed the capacity to make their own decisions. They're kids. It's wrong on every single level. It's never right. It's wrong. Unpatriotic, naive. You can be accused of being dogmatic. You can be accused of being a shill for the corporate media. That's what a lot of people did, that I dared come out against Sanders, who supports this war, which is a corporate war as far as I'm concerned. I think that we don't have to support our politicians anymore. We don't have to support people. You wouldn't support the politicians if they were going into different parts of the world and fucking kids in the mouth. They would all be fired immediately. There would be a revolution. Yet somehow they're supporting the United States military exploding children, which has got to, if there is a scale of bad, that's got to land right after molesting them, right? Like, that's the worst of the worst. So, I don't know. Sanders, great. I like a lot of his policies. I like his drug, his outlook on drugs. But the moment somebody comes out in support of war, I don't know. I feel like it's our job to shame them, call them out, make them feel bad, let them feel it. We're not just war weary, we're war angry. We're angry at the war that our country, this never-ending war that our country keeps participating in. Angry, not weary. Not like we're some cowled sheep. Like we're some tired cows out in the pasture, mooing and braying that we're just tired and weary. No, we're not like that. We're angry. We're angry at the politicians. We're angry at the corporations. We're angry at the spreaders of propaganda that have created a paradigm in which war is an acceptable method to achieve anything on this planet. We're angry at the people who are spreading a paradigm where we're separated by our religion, where we're separated by our borders, where we're separated by our currency, where we're separated by the ideologies that have been planted into our brains by corporations who profit from exploding people. We are one people. That's not hippie drivel bullshit. It's the truth. We have discovered the first habitable planet in our galaxy. It's called Planet Earth, and it's populated with aliens. They're called human beings. And these aliens have somehow gotten infected with a virus that has caused them to view this planet that they're on as something broken up by national identity or by borders. I would much rather have a homogenized planet who've dropped the security blanket of nationalism and religion and idolatry, the worship of our leaders, this disgusting fetishistic S&M behavior that countries engage in, where they allow themselves to fall at the feet of some politician who is hypnotized into thinking and hypnotize them into thinking that he has some level of expertise. This hero worship, this hierarchical control pattern, where at the very top of the pyramid is some well-groomed, charismatic warmonger. The truth is, and you'll never hear this, as far as I'm aware, on any of the news programs that you tune into, you won't find this in the newspapers. For some reason, it just isn't talked about. But the truth is that we are earthlings. We are not Americans. We are not any other nationality. We're just earthlings who exist on a planet together. And if we join up, if we sacrifice whatever the thing is that's creating a divide, if we sacrifice our religion, if we sacrifice our attachment to our religion, if we sacrifice our attachment to our nationality, then what we get as a result is a unified planet where everyone can work together to create miracles on a daily basis. To me, that's preferable. That's preferable. Come on, look at these politicians, whoever they happen to be. They're weirdos. They're weirdos. And their weirdness is becoming increasingly accentuated by our connectivity. Remember when you were a kid and the way that news reporters talked seemed normal to you? That strange cadence that they go into, news speak or whatever it's called. And now, if you're older, it's weird, these people, with their stage makeup on and their iron suits, talking in this strange hypnotic cadence. It's weird. In the same way, it's weird to see these politicians with their stage makeup on, their hair done up, a kind of frenzied look in their eyes. It's weird. All of them are weird. They're not us. They're not like us. Why do we have to follow them? Why do we have to keep following them if they support the very worst possible thing that can happen on this planet? Gleefully, some of them, and if not gleefully, with a kind of nonchalance as though they were talking about going down to the farmer's market to buy kale. So there. That's my POV, friends. I'm not against Bernie Sanders any more than I'm for Hillary Clinton. I'm against blowing people up. Call me a fucking naive hippie asshole if you want to. But I don't know how an orphan in some other country who you're never going to meet is going to be cheered up when you go and tell him, listen, you're part of the little steps we're taking in the direction of peace. You just ended up getting stepped on as we walked in that direction. Sorry, kid. No, be dogmatic. Let him have it. Let him feel the burn. It's just, you know, the dream is that the connectivity offered to us by this incredible internet should begin to unify people in a way that has never been seen in all of human history. That somehow we all connect, we all gather the correct data. Not the data being offered to us by corporate shills, not the data being offered to us by the quote news, which is really just a form of entertainment trying to sell antidepressants and cars, but somehow we gather up the data that exists underneath the never-ending drone of propaganda coming from whatever particular politicians happen to be running whatever country you happen to have gotten shot out of a vagina into. That we have the courage to recognize that brainwashing and propaganda are not the fantasies of conspiracy theorists wearing tinfoil hats, but are in fact the normal operating pattern of power structures. That's just how they run the show. And it doesn't make you a conspiracy theorist to realize that from North Korea to the United States to Canada to Russia, there is a narrative that has been written that isn't based on truth, but is a narrative that has been written by war profiteers and people hungry for power who want as much as they can to justify endless acts of violence and aggression, because from those acts of violence and aggression, they gain power and wealth, and they've become so numb and calloused that that mode of existence seems to them not only to be the correct way to live, but to be the ultimate way to live. You aren't an American. You have no national identity. You're an earthling on a planet filled with people just like you. people who don't want to kill other people, people who don't want there to be war, people who want life to get better here, not just for Americans, but for everyone. We're out there. It's happening. You're just not going to hear about it through the normal conduits, through the normal information transfer channels. You're just not going to hear about it. But I'm telling you, it's out there. It's happening. So many of us are no longer being fooled by the strange, hypnotic patter of the corporate shills who present data to us that is not representative of the way things are actually existing on planet Earth, but is actually perfumed, demonic lies being delivered to us by that black rectangle in our living room in the hopes that it will cause us to become subdued, that it will cause us to become complacent, that it will cause us to become comfortable with our leaders engaging in the vilest activity available to any human being on Earth, which is war. So, that's my two cents on it, friends. Another anti-war rant! Yeah! Sheeple! Woo! It felt good, though. It felt good. I'm not going to keep doing them. Don't worry. Returning to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour podcast is the CEO of Onnit Laboratories, the folks who produce my favorite supplement on Earth, Alpha Brain, which I describe as a low-level Adderall. That's coming from me. It's not coming from them, but I consider that to be a high compliment. They also produce a lot of other cool stuff, amazing exercise equipment, kettlebells with zombies on them, something called a battle mace, which is this iron club that you swing around. They also have their own training academies. You can find out all about this by going to onnit.com. If you live in Austin, in between your floats over at Zero Gravity Float Institute, why not check out DeFranco's gym at the Onnit Academy? Go there. But Aubrey isn't just the CEO of a badass company. He's also somebody who has been on the shamanic path for a great many years. And I don't know anybody who takes such a steady, consistent, and disciplined approach to working with plant medicines than Aubrey Marcus. And I've gotten to watch his personal transformation myself. And we talk about that here on this episode. So now everybody get those pineal glands to start secreting some of that sweet endogenous dimethyltryptamine so that your crown chakra explodes with a volcanic blast of metaphysical astral love and send that firing in the direction of whatever part of the multiverse Aubrey Marcus currently happens to be inhabiting at this very moment. Welcome to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast, Aubrey Marcus. Aubrey Marcus, welcome back to the Duncan Trussell Family Hour Podcast. I got to repeat what I said when I walked in here. I think that you're Batman. Like whenever I come to visit you, it's so cool because you have this, every time I come here, I think I've only been here twice. Have I been here three times or twice?
Maybe once in the real early days.
It gets like 50 times more incredible at this lair that you have here, which is a combination gym. What would you call it? A vitamin company? Is that the name of what Onnit is?
Well, we call it total human optimization. So we're looking at all aspects of improving your performance, you know? So in this headquarters here is all the shit that I love. And that's kind of the secret. You know, I want to have everything available that I would use here, from cryotherapy to infrared sauna to a place where I can train and work out. We're adding some jujitsu, and then we're going to have this thing called the Flow Dojo, which is ways to bring about flow state in your brain through these crazy toys like looping swings. You know, on the swing set where you get to that point where you're like, oh shit, and yeah, the chains go soft and then you fall down.
Yeah.
Well, we're going to have a self-powered swing set where you can go full 360 around in a loop. So we're creating like total fantasy factory style you know, kind of headquarters here, so we can experiment with all of these tools that are available and then be able to talk about them to everybody.
Yeah, you are one of the rare people in the world who walk the walk, which is pretty cool, man. I was thinking that, you know, like I talk the talk, and maybe 10% of the time I will walk the talk. And if I'm lucky, yeah, like 50, or if I do walk the walk, I could only pull it off for like certain periods of my life, and then I degrade. But you seem to have this very consistent, healthy approach to life that doesn't seem to waver that much. Is that because you've built a company around you where you're not allowed to
No, it's actually gone the other way. I've just built a company around what I already loved and was doing anyways. That's why it's easy. Because I think if I was just doing it for the company, I would lose the motivation, because lots of people have companies where it'd be beneficial if they did that, but they don't, because they didn't love that to begin with. You know, they just built a company out of opportunity. I built a company out of everything I fucking love the most, which is training and optimizing my health and fitness and exploring human potential in all aspects. So it's just doing what I love to do. So that's what makes it easy.
But what were you doing pre-Onnit? What was your job?
I had a marketing company, and I was working on a bunch of different stuff, including fleshlights, one of the many different products that I was working with. But I worked in every different industry, you know, from pharmaceutical, working on some, you know, immune therapy, cancer treatments that were preclinical. And then I had some resource, different companies I was working with, skincare, just kind of across the board, and got a good feel.
How old were you when you were doing this? 15?
Started right out of college when I was doing the marketing. But I mean, as far as this path, like taking supplements and figuring out what my potential was, I've been doing that since probably sixth or seventh grade. Yeah, because my stepmom was a nutraceutical doctor, so okay, she would give me like stacks of supplements in a paper towel and just be like, "Hey, take this," and I'd be like, "Yeah, that worked." Or sometimes it'd not work at all. It'd be a total fucking disaster.
Disasters that made you sick or something?
Yeah, I'd get sick or, you know, really just totally out of it. She's like, "Oh yeah, I was experimenting with some stuff. I guess we'll strike that off the list." So I got used to that, and it was just something that I enjoyed doing.
Sometimes I like to think about the concept of this diving board. Because I remember when I was a kid, I was terrified of heights, and there was somehow we would always inevitably end up at a high dive. I don't know how it happened. And I'd always climb up the high dive with my brother, and my brother would jump, and I would always find myself frozen with terror at the very end of this high dive with my friends in the pool making fun of me because it's funny to watch someone frozen in terror, right, or back and just jump. You can't get hurt. Just jump. You got to do it. And I think that kind of paralysis has never really left me. Whenever I get on the precipice of some like risky action, I always find myself frozen, or I find myself just sort of living at the edge of the diving board instead of jumping. You're a person who jumped off the diving board and is always jumping off the diving board. You're an entrepreneur.
Mm-hmm. That's not a hard board for me, though. You know, it's like, you're comparing that, like maybe that's hard for some people, but that's not my heights issue. You know, like I have other areas where I do get frozen. But one thing I've learned particularly recently is the skill I call mental override. And that's just that ability to look at something and assess danger and assess risk. And just even when you do get frozen, say, fuck it, I'm doing this thing, right, like whatever that is. And I've been training that actively myself recently, because I think that's of like supreme benefit. Because otherwise, you rob yourself of your own power, of your own omnipotence. If you say, you know, for example, like one thing I hate is crickets and cockroaches. Like they freak me out, right? So before I would just whatever throw something at them from afar, or deal with them, or just live with them, just because I didn't want to touch them. But now that I'm intentionally practicing mental override, I'll force myself to grab them with my hand and let them outside, right? Because I know they're not going to hurt me. They're not going to bite me or sting me or anything like that. So the act of just forcing myself to do that, it's just this really empowering moment where you're like, oh yeah, I have the power to do that. I have the power to override this thought pattern in my mind and just do it.
Gotcha.
And I think, so whatever it is for people, you know, starting this company hasn't been that, but I have those areas and all kinds of things, whether it's opening up my heart more or touching a cricket or whatever these things that are challenging for me, you still have to apply that just will and intentional choice, which is, you know, what I'm calling
it. And you're calling that mental override.
Mental override.
Is there any kind of technique or is it just a kind of raw force of will?
Yeah, it's just an assertion, just a raw brute force assertion of your consciousness over your mind and a recognition of what power you actually have and a logical analysis of the actual danger that's present. There's zero danger from picking up a cricket with your hand. Zero.
Zero.
Like none. So there's no reason to stop you. So it's just a brute force assault on that part of your mind by your higher consciousness to say, I'm going to do this. My hand is going to move. When I touch it, I'm not going to squeal and pull back because I've done that a billion times too. Like, as soon as you get it, you just go and you gently grab it. And then as it tries to wiggle out your hand, you don't freak out. And then you go do it. And it's this kind of like exposure therapy to these fears until eventually, you know, ideally your fear and danger is exactly in alignment. You know, you're only afraid of the things that are actually dangerous. And that's the point where you're really mastering the game.
How often do you encounter things that are actually dangerous in your life?
Not that often, really. You know, like the fear, the amount of fear that comes over that supersedes the actual danger is pretty significant. I mean, you have to recognize it. Like I'm learning how to ride a motorcycle and there's like actual true danger in that.
Ooh.
And it's, you know, you have to be really aware of that. Like there's no thing. And I think that's why people like riding motorcycles. That's why I like it, is because the danger is so real that it forces you to focus all of your intention into the moment. Because, you know, the wrong bump, the wrong person driving, even if it's out of your control, you have to just be aware of everything. So you can't be worried about other stuff. It really focuses you to the present moment, which in the present moment is, of course, the alleviation of all of our suffering.
The present moment.
Present moment. That's hallowed ground for all of the pain that we feel. I mean, if you're in the present, you know, so much of that mental angst and all of the things going on in your life just evaporate.
Well, everything seems to evaporate there, right?
Yeah.
It's not just the mental angst. It's literally everything.
Everything.
And what's left when everything evaporates?
Your essential self, your consciousness.
How would you define that? What is that?
That is the you that exists pre-birth and post-death. It's the force that animates your body, that animates your life. It's that precondition to this meat vehicle and the postcondition to when it deteriorates. It's just kind of the force of your, it's your life force.
Is it the same thing as the soul?
I think people have called it the soul. Yeah, that's another name for it. Soul, consciousness, God self, whatever you want to call it. I prefer calling it consciousness because that's how I've experienced it. And I've experienced it, of course, in the plant medicines where everything else disappears and you are that. And that's one of the best things that the plants can show you is access of being that force alone without your mind interfering, your ego, these constructs of this great computer we have and this great body we have. When all of that falls away, what you're left with is pretty fucking cool.
It's startling.
Startling.
Because it's suddenly, that's happened to me a few times, not as much as I'd like, but where there's this instantaneous cessation of all neurosis, all suffering, which is mostly just caused by your own fear.
Yep.
It just goes away. Not in the way like when you, not in the way that I'm sure when you pick up a cricket, there's probably still some part of your body that's squirming with like,
right.
It's like all of that just goes away completely.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems whatever it was you were worrying over, no matter how small or how big, it seems as insignificant as whatever you were dreaming about last night.
Yep.
Just a kind of momentary, weird muscle spasm the universe had in the form of your entire existence.
Right.
That's pretty wild, man. That's pretty wild. I guess that's enlightenment, right?
That's, I think, what we're aiming for, yeah. I mean, that's the alleviation of the suffering of the human condition, and it's available to us at any given point. And I think it's why there's been so much attention on things like flow state, you know, like that looping swing. When you're trying to propel your body into a circle where you're going to go upside down, you're pushing past all of these danger signals and alerts. And in the doing of that, it locks you into the present moment. And right. in that present moment is what they call the flow state, which is one of the most pleasurable experiences we can encounter. I mean, not only from the neurochemicals that get released, but just the cessation of all of that aspect of fear and mind and anxiety and ego and positioning and all of these things that we're constantly worried about. You know, that's it. And then the key is, how do you stretch that for as long a period as possible? And I know it's possible because I've seen people who live that way.
Like,
you know,
who?
Don Miguel Ruiz, the author of Four Agreements and The Mastery of Love.
You've
spent a week with him out in Punta Mita in Mexico.
That's crazy, man. That book is such an intense book.
Yeah. Which one? Mastery of Love or
the Four Agreements?
Yeah.
I have not read The Mastery of Love yet.
Love.
A friend of mine sent me The Four Agreements, which is one of these books where you can read it in an hour or two. It's not a long book, but it's like the Bhagavad Gita. It's like every little piece of it is, you could think about it for your entire life.
Yep.
So first of all, how did you end up going to meet him?
So he had like a little workshop out in this, you know, I've been a fan of his work, Four Agreements. Mastery of Love, I think, is his masterpiece work. And so I just wanted to kind of catch a vibe, listen to him, interact with him, see what he was all about in the flesh. Because, you know, a lot of times with these different, you know, masters of thought, you'll meet them. And I'm very good about appreciating the person regardless of what you see before you. But you generally see like, okay, he was really good at this, but he has, you know, he's still working on these areas.
Right.
But with Don Miguel, it was cool to see someone who's really walking the walk.
Right.
You know, like that dude is implacable. Like he has complete sovereignty of what his emotions might try and do to him. You know, like he controls what those aspects of fear, anxiety, what he calls the parasite. He's in complete control of the parasite. And
right.
when you're in complete control of the parasite, you're just living in this blissful state. I mean, the dude is radiantly happy
right.
and full of love at all different points and refuses to accept any reality from anybody else that would impinge upon that, and demands the impeccability of himself and those around him, you know, as well. It's just really fucking cool.
When you
cool
say
to
he
see
demands it.
Well, with his family. So here's an interesting story. So his sons are like he's mentored his sons in his way, in the Toltec way, you know, so he demands it of them probably more than other people, you know. So his son tells a story of he had a serious stroke or a heart attack issue where he was in the hospital and it looked like he wasn't going to make it. And he's all hooked up to tubes. He's almost incoherent. And his son comes in and starts going, "Oh, Papa, oh, Papa," and starts crying, you know, losing control of his emotions in the hospital room. And Don Miguel hears this, you know, and just sits up in bed. First time he'd sat up in bed in a while and like looks his son dead in the eye. And he says, "Is this how you honor your father? Go fix yourself."
Jesus.
And points to the door, right? The son's like, "Whoa, what the fuck?" Leaves the room, gets control of his emotions, comes back.
Well, now I can hear some people listening are like, "What a dick. Let your son
he's so
cry.
Callous.
He loves you. He loves you. Let him cry." But then that makes me think of the verse in the Bhagavad Gita that is always like, sometimes it's awesome and sometimes I'm like, no, that can't be the way to live. But it makes you think of this verse: "The wise mourn neither for the living nor for the dead."
Mm-hmm.
Fuck. That's crazy to think about a life of not mourning. It's crazy to think about a life of not, "Oh no, you're dying, daddy."
Right.
But just a state of like, yeah, you're going to transform. Maybe you're going to have this massive transformation that happens to you right now, but I know you're not going anywhere. And I know that you're not going to be apart from me. You're just different. You're being born into a different version of you.
Totally.
Well, that sounds sociopathic to a lot of people.
And it's hard for people. Like I was there with my girlfriend Whitney and she was listening, and you know, from the female perspective, some of these stories are hard, you know, but I could get it because his son has chosen his path and is going to be passing on the legacy. It was Junior, you know, Don Miguel Ruiz Junior, right? He's passing on the legacy. So this was like potentially a final lesson. Like the final lesson that he was passing on. He ended up living and he's still thriving to this day. So all worked out even better. But he does that also with his intimate relationships too. So he basically has a variety of women that he's seeing, and he has simple agreements with them. And the agreement is, I agree to love you generously and receive your love graciously. And that's the only agreement he has with them. I will give my love generously and receive your love graciously.
Wow.
No other agreements, no other requirements, no other obligations. That's it. So when anybody impinges upon that, he refuses to accept it. And for like the female mind, it sounds callous. Like he would give an example of someone coming to him with some jealousy, or, you know, someone crying and jealous and worried, and some of the normal programs that we find in regular relationships. And he would say, he basically very calmly says, I don't have time for your emotions. Please go fix yourself.
Damn.
You know, and he's implacable with that, right?
Yeah.
And that's not going to work for night. That's not like relationship advice. Like, don't do that. That's not going to work unless you're...
Yeah, I'd like to... I should record me saying that to my girlfriend.
Yeah, it is a total disaster if you try that.
But I think if my girlfriend said that to me, what are you talking... Oh, yeah, I'll go fix myself.
Yeah.
Do you have any airplane glue that what are you talking about?
Right.
Well, you know what? The thing about it is this, man. These beings... And if you've never encountered one of these beings before, then I understand your skepticism. But when you encounter them, you're standing in front of a whole different creature. And, you know, they're radiating that thing that you're talking about. There's an emanation of some kind of, as of yet, unmeasurable energy field that I've often thought a great study would be to take, and I don't know how you'd pull it off, but just as a thought experiment, take people like Ram Dass, Thich Nhat Hanh, all of them, the Dalai Lama, and somehow get another group of people who hadn't really practiced at all, and then have groups of people see if they can identify which ones have spent their entire lives living according to some spiritual path and which ones haven't.
Yeah.
Maybe even do it in the dark.
Yeah.
So just see if they could sense it, because this, when I'm at Ram Dass, you know, whenever you're around that guy, it's like, it doesn't matter what mood you're in. It doesn't matter what your hangups are. It doesn't matter what programs you're running, as you're saying.
Mm-hmm.
You get around that guy, and just for a second, when you're around him, that stuff just starts dissolving. And all of a sudden, you're in this lighter, happier, more ecstatic, sweet place, just because whatever's running, juicing out of him is like getting into the... It's like there's a contact high.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm sure it's the same with your mentor.
No doubt. Yeah, I mean, he's... I've only spent that 1 week with him, but what I appreciated from that was the ability to have not... just to not be in constant struggle with our own demons, our own parasite, our own judge, all of these different things that are our antagonists, what Stephen Pressfield calls resistance. You know, and in like... in the Pressfield paradigm, you're always at battle with resistance,
yes.
You know, and most of us encounter that. And that's the definition of a warrior, is someone who's willing to battle resistance.
Right.
And a lot of people just surrender to it and say, I'm just getting fucked up. My life sucks. Fuck it.
Right.
Then there's the warriors who just generally battle it. And then occasionally you run into one of these people that have transcended the game, where that voice may come, but it's this squeaky little voice that's easy to ignore. Like, the sound of your air conditioning coming on or something like that. Like, they've transcended that to such a degree that they're not in struggle anymore.
Right.
They're just in bliss.
And those guys aren't going to fucking play the rules of the game the way you're playing it. They just don't.
No.
Like, and they're not going to. And there's stories, you know, about Neem Karoli Baba, Ram Dass's guru.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, everything he did was a teaching, but the stuff that he did was not like... stuff that's like gonna go over really well. So I mean, he would, you know, he would send people away. He would like, he was ferocious in his own loving way, but there was always a purpose behind it. So it's interesting hearing about Don Miguel and saying go fix yourself, because there's all these stories about how Neem Karoli Baba Maharaji, as they called him, would I can't remember the word. There's a word in he would use that meant go, and no one wanted to hear it.
Yeah,
because when you were around him, you just wanted to be around him.
Right.
I mean, people would travel a long way, and they would try really hard to find him just to be in his presence, because he was like just this explosion of love. But then he would ask like some of the hippies or some of the people, what's your relationship like with your mom or your dad? And they would say, oh, we don't get along. And he'd be like, go back to the United States and get and fix that and then come back.
Yeah.
He would make you leave, you know, he'd make you deal with that stuff. It's really cool.
So Don Miguel calls it ruthless love. Like, and ruthless love is a love that's so strong that it refuses to permit, you know, someone to act out suffering upon themselves.
Right.
You know, it's like, it's not a coddling kind of love. Like, oh, come here, boo-boo, it'll be okay. Right. Which, as you know from, you know, parenting, anytime you do that to a kid when they get hurt, the hurt's going to hurt worse.
Right.
You know, like, oh, baby, you hurt yourself. And the kid's like, yeah, I did.
Right.
You know, but when you refuse to acknowledge that and just say, no, you're fine. You know, you can fix yourself. You have the power to control this wave that's going inside of you.
Right.
You know, and just go take care of it and then come back and then we'll deal with our consciousness rather
than this
other thing. Yeah.
Don Miguel's a daddy.
Yeah. Got several sons.
He represents, but he's literally represents sort of the masculine father, Shiva energy.
100%.
That's what he is. And we need the other side too, though. I mean, it's, we can't always send your kid away who's weeping. Sometimes the kid needs the mommy.
No doubt.
You need both. There no needs doubt. To be balance. I wonder what, you know what I mean? Like, what is the mirror of that?
Yeah, I agree. But it's also that he's so full of love that it's not a sternness at which he does it. Like, even the act itself contains love. And his love's there waiting without judgment when the kid comes back. It's not like, you fucked up, I'm not going to love you as much. So this conditional paradigm where it's like, you know, I'm still judging you for your former actions. As soon as you're back, you're met with, you know, perfect unconditional love, or at least as close as the human representation can be.
Nuts. Getting scolded by someone who actually is doing it out of love, or getting that is so different than getting scolded from, like, I don't know what
from
you
the judge's perspective,
right?
Which is what we do to ourselves all the time. We're constantly scolding ourselves, punishing ourselves, thinking that we're not worthy,
right?
You know, because we've learned that's been patterned in us from society, from teachers to friends to girlfriends to parents. You know, that's the paradigm. You close off your love when you're upset with somebody because emotions are driving that decision rather than love driving that decision.
Right. Close off your love. Yeah. Like, that's even possible. You know, like, it's such a, that is so dark. Anytime I'm doing that, anytime you withdraw your love to punish somebody, like you're some kind of heroin dealer and you're like, no, I'm not selling you any of the dope today. Just suffer in the darkness. That's so ridiculous. It's such an insanely sadistic thing to do to a person that you supposedly love.
And you know, so many people think of, oh yeah, I treat my so-and-so really well, you know, like I'm like a perfect kind of boyfriend, girlfriend, parent, whatever label that is, because I don't hit them, or I don't like whip them, or I don't yell at them.
Right.
Well, it's the closing off of the love that's probably the most damaging, way more than the actual sting of the lash or the strike of the hand. I mean, that's just a physical representation of the lack of love.
Right.
And all of us are playing these love give and love take games, which are patterning these conditional love paradigms, which is what we're running on ourselves, which is why it's so hard for us to love ourselves, because we internalize the same thing. And because we've internalized it, we externalize it and push that out on other people as well. And that's the thing, you know, in Mastery of Love that Don Miguel talks about breaking that cycle of conditional love patterning.
This is something that brings to mind Ram Dass. I don't know. I'm bringing up Ram Dass a lot today, but he talks about the the concept of being in love.
Mm-hmm.
So he says, "I am in love. Like right now, I'm existing inside of love. So if you're with me, we're in love together. That's what we're experiencing. We're in love together. It's but this love that I'm in right now, it's not dependent on you." It's not the being in love. If you go away, if you decide, whatever happens, I'm still in love, because we all exist inside of love. When a lot of people think that being in love is a state that only happens when you meet the right person, and then that is always followed by heartbreak or whatever, and this weird cycle.
It's dependency and attachment is what that creates.
Dependency and attachment, yeah. And no one wants to hear, most people don't want to hear, you know, I love being around you. You're just wonderful. But if I'm not around you, I'm still going to feel love no matter what.
Exactly.
And that, if you say that to some people, they'll be like, what the fuck are you talking about?
Well, it's like some people are conditioned that they, you know, you meet people who want a controlling partner. You want, they want someone who gets jealous, you know, because that to them is how they've been programmed to, you know, identify love. It's, oh, they're possessive. They're possessive of me. They, you know, that you get stuck in these cycles where it's the exact opposite. You know, like you want a situation where everybody is completely full of love.
Right.
And whether you take part in that or not, it's not going to impact the amount of love they feel for themselves and the amount of love they feel for the world. And you know, it also shatters this kind of scarcity paradigm about love too, whereas people really believe that if you, you know, if you love somebody, there's no room to love anybody else. You know, like, oh, that's all the love. And if you love somebody else, you're taking away our love. You know,
right.
Like it's a finite resource, which is bullshit. And it's bullshit. We know it when we're parents. No one asks, oh, man, when you had the third kid, how did it feel to love each of your other two kids one third less? People would look at you like, what the fuck are you talking about? I got infinite love for all my kids.
Right.
But in the romantic paradigm, it's like there's a finite amount. You got 100 points of love, and if you spend 10 on this other old friend or an old lover or something like that, then that means you only got 90 left for me. So you're an asshole.
Well, I mean, the problem is when you're talking about monogamy versus non-monogamy is that it's not a perfect world. So it's not as though like you can just be with some other person and another, like two people at once. If that is happening, you've got to be super evolved, and everyone in that equation needs to be super evolved too.
Right.
And the problem is that's not always the case.
No.
So that's where it's not that kind of lifestyle. When people pull it off, I think it's incredible. And I think, man, you've got to feel great. Like you've overcome one of the, a huge thing, but on another level, I think there really is something beautiful about the game of jealousy. To me, it's like we can't just abandon the aspect of playing a game when you're in a relationship. You know, It's like there is something to this, like in Hare Krishna mythology, there is the Srimad Bhagavatam is what it's called. And the Srimad, so the Bhagavad Gita is the beginner book. The Srimad Bhagavatam is like this, like, crazy book about Krishna, the mythology of Krishna, falling in love with Krishna, what it's like to be with Krishna. And all these different states of being with Krishna are called, and forgive me, Hare Krishna's out there if I'm messing this up a little bit, they're called Leelas, the Leelas, or the different, like, ways that you can interact with God. And so examples from the mythology, they look at this mythology of Krishna living with his friends, the gopis, in this like heaven-like Peter Pan-like paradise called Goloka Vrindavan, which is this like super incredible, beautiful place where everything's alive and every atom and particle is like has the greatest karma in the universe because it gets to be so close to the personified version of the Godhead. But
sure. They're
in Goloka Vrindavan. In fact, this entire universe that we're in right now is just a kind of, some people say it's the, what we are experiencing right now. And this is, there's various versions of bhakti yoga. This is a controversial thing to say. But some people say that what we're experiencing right now is actually the orgasm of God and God's lover as they make love in Goloka Vrindavan. And it's such an intense moment that it expands an entire universe. And that's what we're inside of right now. But the, how does Krishna interact with Radha, his lover, Radharani, the feminine side of God? And so there's all these different interactions they have. And sometimes Krishna pisses off Radharani. And, or not pisses her off, but they get in tiffs. They still get in like, or she longs for him. He goes away with his friends and she longs for him. There's a form of jealousy there. There's a form of spiritualized desire there, which is like really quite beautiful and wonderful.
But is that just anthropomorphizing what humans are feeling and projecting that upon the divine, or is that coming the other way, would be my question. But I'm not saying that, look, I'm in favor of accepting the reality of what we carry in this body.
Right.
You know, like, and I think the Toltecs, like Castaneda, who is a crazy fuck, by the way, he's a fucking nut job. But he
so in Lizard's Eyes Shut.
Yeah, but he had some good ideas. And one of his good ideas was he called those actions your controlled folly. Like,
that's cool.
You could indulge in those, and you should, you know, but know that it's folly.
Yeah.
So if you want to play the jealousy longing game, like, feel that, because it brings up things that are part of the human condition that are awesome. Like, as you know, I aspire to the kind of the poet's aspect of looking at things where you want to feel these things.
Yes.
Like, I've written some of my best stuff when I was tortured by this longing and jealousy.
Yes.
And I would feel like I got robbed from this life if I never felt that.
Right.
But it would have been cool if I knew that that was my controlled folly back then, instead of just being headlong into it, because there was massive periods of just bleak darkness and suffering that were also attached to that, that I would have liked to, like, take the good part of just feeling that emotion, but then being able, when I was done with it, be like, yeah, that's all silly anyways. That was my controlled folly. I indulged in that thing, and now I'm over it.
See, that's the thing, man. Controlled folly. That's a beautiful way to put it. And I think there's a big difference between amnesic folly, where you fully fall into the role of a jealous person, versus the controlled folly. There's a million light years between those two states, because one is a spiritualized version of that. Like, I don't know. Have you ever gotten in a fight with someone that you love? And during that fight, you're looking at them, and even though you're fighting, you see how much they love you. And even though, you know, you're fighting with them, that you both see how much you love each other during the fight, to the point where the fight dissolves. It just seems ridiculous. And you're like, what are we doing? And it's so cool, because in that case, the love sort of, like, evaporates the fight. Or even if the fight continues, it's no more serious than a game of Monopoly or something. I'm sorry to keep bringing up Ram Dass. This example he uses, he says, okay, so we're playing Monopoly, right? If you and me play Monopoly, Monopoly is a shit game in the sense you're meant to, like, get control of the board, do shady bargains, try to, like, you know, mess the person up on purpose so you can win. So if you and me play Monopoly, like, just full of love and just rolling the dice and, like, here you go. Then we're just running some boring math problem.
Sure. It's like poker without actual money involved.
Right.
Or clothes or whatever stake actually matters.
Yeah. What's the point?
Yeah.
When I play Monopoly with somebody, I expect them to get mean, because I'm going to get mean. Yeah. And if they're mean during Monopoly, I don't think, this guy's a monster. I just think, that's how you play Monopoly. You play like that, and it's fun. But the point is, once Monopoly's over, then it's done.
And at any point, laughter is available.
Yeah.
You know, like, that's cool. Like, the key to all of this. You know, like, if at any point laughter is an available option where you could just bust out and just kind of laugh, then I think you're doing it right.
Right.
You know,
that's a good,
because there's other people who play these board games and they'll fucking lose and throw the board and storm off.
Right.
And they're like, what the fuck's happened to so-and-so? They're lost in their
rage quit.
Rage quit.
That's what suicide bombing is, right? It's a form of rage quitting.
In our own video game. Yeah. But then, you know, there's laughter isn't available, and it's silly at that point. You know, like, even if you rage quit at that point, right after you're done throwing the controller or whatever, you should be able to just look, connect with a, you know, shred of consciousness and just laugh.
Yes.
Like, that was funny.
Yes, exactly. You know? Yeah. That's a great way to put it. And that's how you know, if you can't find that laughter and whatever's going on, then you need to take some time, probably.
Mm-hmm.
My friend just told me this saying, which I love. This guy, Mike Kaplan, got a great podcast, but he said, you've probably heard this before, Aubrey, strike while the iron's cold. You ever heard that before?
I have a quote from William Butler Yeats that says, "Do not wait to strike till the iron is hot, but make the iron hot by striking."
Wow.
Which is another quote.
I got to do the math on that one for a second. I'm going to sit down with the pen and paper and calculate that. So I wanted to talk to you a little bit about this. You recently had kind of intense psychedelic experience. And every time we podcast together, you've recently had an intense psychedelic experience. But this one, just to bring the listeners up to speed who maybe missed prior episodes, you had this very intense ayahuasca experience where you dissolved into nothingness. You said that you felt like, what is the term that you use? Because it's so intense, like less than the something on the shoot. What is
it? Well, so ayahuasca takes you to an escalating acceptance of your fears. The first fear that we're all afraid of is the fear of dying, right? But so ayahuasca took me to that in my first sessions with ayahuasca. And then it move past that to the fear of suffering and started going through these escalations. But after I got through fear of dying and fear of suffering, I thought I was pretty much done. So I thought it was kind of like a cakewalk from there. Oh no, it wasn't quite a cakewalk. There was another fear, because in my own belief system, the consciousness, as I mentioned at the beginning, transcends death. And I had attachments to the type of consciousness that I was. I felt like, you know, I had a purpose that would extend beyond this life, and that was important. There was a certain importance to my consciousness that I was attached to. So in the ayahuasca session I did at Don Howard's place, which was a grueling four ceremony session with really strong medicine, it was taking me deeper and deeper to find this root fear that still existed, this fear that was based on an attachment. And it came to a kind of a head at the point where it took that from me. And what it said is that, you know, you are nothing. You are less than nothing. This is ayahuasca talking. You're nothing. You are less than nothing. You are the gum on nothing's shoe.
That's it. Okay, yeah, yeah.
You are water borrowed from the ocean, and the ocean forgot. You know, so, and at that point, I just started sobbing. Like, it was like an acceptance that, okay. And it released the attachment to the specialness of this consciousness. And then what came, my grandmother came in and visited me, because I was at sheer hopelessness at that point, right? And then her voice started to build me back up and said, it's like, now that you've accepted that, you know, you're ready to fight. And it's time to fight. It's time to fight against all your old enemies, fear, greed, ignorance, all of these things that are outside. Like, the Maloka was a kind of a paradigm for the whole world. Like, all of these things that are haunting mankind, like, you're here to fight. Right. So get up. And I was like lying down. I was like, no, just sobbing and like blibbering and vomit and drool and tears. He's like, get up, Aubrey, get up. I was like, I can't. He's like, get up, you will. And I stood up, and then it was just kind of the embracement of my purpose, which is to fight against these enemies that are all of our common enemy. And so that was a really, really powerful moment, because it took me to the very core of nothingness and then rebuilt me with a singular purpose, you know, para el bien de todos, as they say, for the good of all.
How do you say it again? Cool.
Para el bien de todos.
Para el bien de todos.
For the good of all.
For the good of all.
Yeah.
So you were resurrected. You experienced a annihilation, resurrected by your ancestors.
Yeah.
And so that brings us up to speed. And so now you have done another ceremony.
Yeah. So what I was endeavoring to do was to do a dieta, it's called, which is where you work with a specific plant, a non-psychedelic plant, and you learn the teachings from that plant.
This is Toltec still.
This is ayahuasca. This is ayahuasca mythology, like curandero, like South American shaman tradition.
In Carlos Castaneda, that was one of the things that to me was really striking about the way that they were using plant medicines. Beyond respectful, the way that they would harvest the peyote, or the way that they would grow the datura, was so.
Because these are ascended masters to them. These plants are not just plants. They're ascended masters that have chosen plant form, because to choose human form would be silly. It's too limiting. You know, the nature of their consciousness is so vast, they could only express themselves in plant form.
Right.
You know, because humans are too capricious and too fallible. And so plant form made the most sense for these ascended masters, these coalescences of consciousness to come down as teachers. They had to be plants.
Cool.
So when they're interacting with the plants, they're interacting like with the venerated body of an ascended master.
Wow.
You know, so that's how they deal with it. And it's not just the psychedelics that are plants, like all of the plants are masters in some way.
Wow.
That have chosen to come down in this manifestation as plants.
That's so cool. That is so the opposite of the way most people think.
Oh, totally.
Gonna go mow the lawn.
Yeah, exactly.
Goddamn grass.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah.
So each of these trees, so the ayahuasca shaman, each of these trees have certain properties and certain things that they can teach them. And so they actually take the plant into their body. They, you know, ingest it in some form or another. And then they ask the spirit to take root inside their light body, to kind of bolster their light body, to add more weight to their coalescence and teach them lessons. And that's the paradigm that they operate under. So the greater the master, the more plants that he has within his light body. Some plants are for protection. A lot of the dark shamans use plants for, you know, attack and aggression. Wow. And there's plants for healing. There's plants for all kinds of different things. Ayahuasca being the master plant, which helps kind of bridge everything and bring all of these together. But all the plants have value. So the process of dieta is the process of working with one specific plant and trying to learn all the lessons from that plant. Okay. So that's the paradigm. For me, I don't have any connection with these jungle plants other than going down and doing ayahuasca. So I wanted to see what this technology was about, because this is like their technology. Right. This is their spiritual technology. So I chose the plant rose, you know, just the flower rose.
Cool.
Something that I've connected with my life, and it's kind of ubiquitous. It's around.
Right.
Non-traditional, but using the traditional way to do it. So we open with two ceremonies. And those two ceremonies were really beautiful, and asking the spirit of Rose to come be my guide for the next 3 weeks. And I'd be in total isolation where I couldn't touch anybody. You're not supposed to dream about sex. You're not supposed to have sex. You're not supposed to eat bad food. You're not supposed to dream about bad food. They don't even make a difference between waking and dreaming life. Like, you have to have total control, austerity over all aspects of yourself. And no non-shaman can even touch your body during the first opening part until you move on to the second part, in which you can have limited contact. But anyways, I was going off to British Columbia to do this diet. So we invoke Rose. Rose shows up in ceremony, and it was this beautiful amalgamation of this giant, like, octopus-like creature that was unfathomable
this
in size.
This is while on ayahuasca.
This is under plant medicines, which I can't really talk about. Okay. Which ones, but this is under some, you know, under some plant medicine.
Yes.
Opening the ceremony. And and it was really sweet and really gentle, and this figure came, and it was Rose. And instead of all of the suckers on the tentacles, there was millions of roses. But this was so big that it was billions of roses, like fractal roses.
Right.
And this octopus, like, and it just drifted in and, like, you know, made herself known. And then I could communicate with her after that. So for the next 3 weeks, I would communicate with her. And she was a stern, stern taskmaster. Like, she really challenged me. And it was a very challenging and enlightening period.
Challenge you how?
So, okay, remember we talked about withdrawing love? Like, I'll just give an example. It was the process brought up a lot of my own demons and things that I had to deal with. So one of them, which was, I got into a fight with Whitney while I was gone.
Right.
And I could feel myself doing that, where I would withdraw love. And I wasn't being like calling her a bitch or anything. That's not part of what I do, but I was withdrawing love and doing it in a punitive way. Right? Because I was mad. I was like livid at her for some stuff.
Yeah.
And I could feel myself doing that. And all of a sudden, Rose comes in and is like, "You want to see yourself?" And I was like, "Ugh." And it showed me. And it showed me as this like gorilla demon, this gorilla face with horns.
Fuck.
And I grabbed the roses by the petals and squashed them in my hands. And the stalks had all these thorns. And Whitney was like naked and cowering. And I was just beating her with the thorns of the roses. It's like, "This is you." And I was like, "Fuck." You know, like, it was like, wake up, you know, this is what you're doing. I don't know what, you know, excuses you're using to justify this action, but this is really what you're doing by withdrawing that love. So it would show me these like demon aspects of myself and challenge me with different
nuts, man.
Things that would come to my psyche. And it was really a trying time. So 3 weeks of that goes by.
Wow.
Other demons I would, you know, witness and things that would go on, and nightly visions of, you know, there'd be visions of snake. And I was on nothing then. I'm eating really clean food, meditating, writing my book. Vision, nightly visions before I'd go to sleep. And these figures, these giant snakes would come to attack me. And at first I tried to fight them, but that didn't work. The snakes just wanted to fight. It was just like this endless fight, like war in the Middle East or some shit. Like,
right.
Just the more you fight, the more aggression it came, until the only way to make peace with them was to assert your own autonomy and power, but with love. Just be like, "I am you. I love you. Let's, you know, you can't attack me because we're the same. We're all part of consciousness. We're inseparable." Wow. You know, and at that point, they all settle down and they're like, "Cool." And then they're like your allies. So I'm like struggling with these things. And that process for me to figure that out was like a week of kind of hell. Because I'm like getting eaten by snakes like nightly.
Now, how did you rationalize, like, on one level, this thing that's happening to you is obviously it's amazing, but how do you figure that you were witnessing these entities minus some psychoactive plant medicines inside of you?
Well, I think what these plant medicines, a lot of the shamans call them, they call them chakarunas, which are bridges. So really they're not creating any of the apparitions. They're just bridging you to the place where the apparitions are. Whether that's in your own mind or in another dimension, doesn't matter. They're bridging you to that place where those things are.
Right.
And once you've established that bridge enough, you can pull the plants away and the bridge still exists. It's like it forms the kind of structure for the bridge, and then eventually you can take the bridge away and you still have the access to that.
Wow.
And that's ultimately, you know, which I'll get to, one of the reasons why that I consider my plant medicine journey done. Because that bridge has been so well established, like on an airplane, I can put on some binaural beats and I can have as intense a psychedelic encounter or visions. I just had a recent vision with this gigantic pearlescent dragon, which took me to my childhood. And this is like on an airplane, listening to with my eyes closed. Like I have access to that. It's still a choice. It's not like they come and haunt me.
Right.
Like I'm getting LSD flashbacks and right. hiding under the table. It's like if I choose to go to that place, you know, I have access to that place now where these visions can come and lessons can be learned, whether that's a place in my own mind or a place.
It's so funny.
It doesn't matter.
In the goddamn West, you always have to say that, don't you? Like, you have to, anytime you talk about something like that, because mm-hmm. otherwise people are like, you've gone crazy. You have to be like, I recognize this much. It's been in my brain.
Yeah.
It sucks. No, in so many other cultures, you don't have to say that because people don't think about that question because they don't differentiate the inside from the outside. So they're like, yeah, whatever.
And that's, I think, the secret. It is the same thing.
Yes.
It's the same thing. We're all little universes in and of ourselves. And so that whole paradigm doesn't really hold up when you go there.
What you're talking about here is something that has been validated by so many different teachers who I love, who say again and again, you don't need the psychedelics. There are things that you can do that will place you into the most extreme, incredible psychedelic states that make psychedelics seem like coming down mm-hmm. compared to where you can go minus the psychedelic. And I love the term bridge because mm-hmm. it's way better than the term that has often been used, which is elevator. Because, you know, people say you do the substance, go up in the elevator to some incredible party, look around, and then you go back down. And now you've got to figure out a way to get back to that party. And so you keep getting high, trying to get back to this incredible, beautiful, supernatural state. But bridge is a much better way to put it. It's a much better way, because I know that, though I haven't had the experience with plant medicines that you have, I don't have your discipline, man. I don't know if I could do that.
You totally could.
I don't know, but I do know this I do know that, like, if I spend just a little bit of time in the moment, I can reset my paradigm to like a magical paradigm.
No doubt. Choice.
Choice. Yeah.
And that was another thing. So I'll finish off kind of what led me to this final thing. And one thing I also realize is that these plants, when you use a bridge, you have to contend with the bridge. And sometimes the bridge is gnarly. Like the bridge is like covered in thorns and snakes, and it's a gnarly bridge that you're putting in place. Whereas the most elegant way to do it is with an ethereal bridge that doesn't really exist. So like shamanic breathing is still a bridge, but it's an air bridge, and it's really easy to contend with, you know, getting to a psychedelic state with holotropic breathing, like Dr. Stan Grof kind of developed that method.
Yes.
Doing something like a boga or ayahuasca, fuck yeah, it'll get you there, but you're contending with a motherfucker of a bridge.
Right.
That bridge has its own agenda, its own ideas.
Hey, what lives under bridges, man?
Yeah, totally. You trolls. Got trolls. You got trolls under those bitch. You know, you got all kinds of stuff happening underneath there. So, and that becomes a challenge in and of itself to kind of deal with. So ultimately, it's better to not have a bridge, you know. And the ayahuasca bridge, you get really nauseous. You know, it's really challenging. It's one of the things that brings up a lot of these fears is how physically uncomfortable you are.
Right.
And eventually when you have that access, that's why even the shamans, they drink less and less and less and less and less because they're almost doing it ceremoniously at that point, so right. that they just take a little bit in honor of this great teacher. You know, and it's not to diminish what these plants offer by just saying they're only a bridge. There are many more things than that. They have lessons that they can teach themselves. But, you know, it's almost to honor that bridge and to honor that teacher. And then, but still they're accessing it through their normal ways. And they can access it without it as well. So anyways, I go to close the ceremony. Same setup as before, where I'm having these beautiful encounters. And it gets incredibly gnarly. So the intention was to take consciousness at large, the consciousness of Rose and the consciousness at large, and put it at root in my own physical being, right? Instead of accessing it there on the other side, experiencing consciousness at large collectively,
yes,
out somewhere else on the other side of the bridge, bring it home, bring it into the heart.
So cool.
And I don't think we really recognize what that would entail, because what that entails is it entails all the darkness and all the light. And entails every bit of creation and every bit of destruction. And it's all equally beautiful.
Okay.
And that's a fucked up thought to have.
Right.
Is to see death and dying and suffering and all of these things as equally beautiful as life and ecstasy and bliss and all of these things. Because it's part of the game. It's part of the substrate upon which creation is thrust. It is the orgasm of this, of creation, consciousness, and physical manifestation. You know, that's part of it. So to take all of that inside meant that I had to reconcile all of the evil, all of the destruction, all of everything that was bad in the universe, and everything that was good, and say, all of that's me. Like, I'm all of that.
Right.
And that was incredibly terrifying, because you don't want to recognize the dark parts as part of you. You want to say, oh, I'm separate from that. You know, but if you're putting consciousness inside you, consciousness is everything. It's the whole game. And it was at a point where I really felt like I was anteing up my sanity. And if I would have chosen, and there was this like a simple crossroads there, where it was a choice of either to indulge fear or to have faith that I'd make it out, because I had no idea. I was not prepared for this at all. Like, and there was another choice, which was to choose power, which was to try and take this in. And it was just like the demon choice, right?
Right.
And I was like, I could see that path too.
Fuck.
And that path was an alleviation of the fear. So there's two ways to deal with the fear. One was to embrace it and become the fear maker. And then in that case, you know, you were alleviated from the fear, but that was the demonic path.
Now you're a bully.
Yeah. And then the other choice was the faith path and to choose love. And that was the stable way out. That was the way ultimately out. But it was a gnarly choice, because it was just like, what are you going to do? What are you going to do, buddy? Like, here you are. You know, here's fear. Here's faith. Here's power. Here's love. You know, choose. It's like, you're all of it. You're everything. You're not predisposed to one or the other. You are you are your choice that you make right now, and the choice that you make every single day. That's what you are. You know, it's not that you're inherently good or inherently bad or inherently, you're everything, and you're just the summation of these choices like this moment. And I was able to choose, you know, love and faith, because that was what was most stable, and that's what my heart longed to do. Everything else seemed delusional to a certain degree, you know, and it didn't make sense. So I chose my way out of that situation, and it was a really empowering moment, because it really gave me the power of choice back, it gave me like true free will to have all of the options laid out and just be like, you're everything, bro. Like, you are whatever you want. What do you choose? And then, so it wasn't that I was inherently good and I'm just choosing good things because that's my nature. It was just, no, you're everything. Here's your choice.
That's fucking cool.
So I got to choose who I am at that point and recognize that so much of everything that we have is just that choice.
I love that, man. That's so cool, because it's like, you know, everyone's waiting to make this choice, but they're trying to make their choices according to some emotional compass.
Yeah.
Instead of recognizing that, no, you don't make these decisions because you feel some way for like good or evil, right or wrong.
Right.
You make these choices just because you can, based on a pure existential, purely existential reality. And this is the reality that when I was a long time ago in college, when I was studying existentialism, there was like light existentialism and dark existentialism. And the dark existentialism, they would say like Jean-Paul Sartre was our philosophy professor called it black hat existentialism, which is his, he would say, listen, here's the deal. All right. You're fucked. The universe fucked up. You ended up becoming this thing that's essentially meaningless. A paper cutter is a thing that has a purpose. It cuts paper. That's what it does. There's no question about it. The paper cutter isn't aware of itself, but that's its job. It cuts fucking paper. That's what it does. Maybe it could be used as a club or something, but it's a paper cutter.
Right.
Human being? No way, baby. You ain't a paper cutter. You're nothing. You're nothing. You don't have any purpose. You're pure, absolute. This is the gum. He stops at the gum on the shoe. Yeah. He's like, look, you have to decide what you're going to be in every single fucking second. And it doesn't matter because whatever you decide, it's still completely absurd. It is completely meaningless, whatever you're doing. It's really fucking dark. And so that sense of like vertigo that comes from that realization of just like, yeah, I'm no matter what I do, I'm always playing some part. This is called nausea.
Yeah.
Is what he called. So the other version of that is like, okay, but here's the deal. You're saying I'm cursed by my freedom to decide what I'm going to be. I say it's the ultimate power that anything in the universe could possibly be given, you fucking grumpy French meth addict. Yeah. What are you fucking talking about? I can at any moment that I want, no matter what situation I'm in, not based on any emotional component inside of me, decide that this is the greatest moment of all time.
Yep.
I can make that decision. Yep. And from making that decision, I can emanate love and beauty and light into a world where so many people are just walking around like fucking nauseated zombies, unaware maybe of the burden of having to be a thing, but still harassed by a constant state of anxiety, fear, and anger. So that's what this reminds me of, man. Mm-hmm. It sounds like you moved from the dark side into the light side.
Totally.
Like
and this, that ability, that is the greatest gift. Like that's why we set this game up with all of these things, with a darkness that's equal to the light,
right,
so that there is actual choice. Like, yeah, imagine if there was no resistance to enlightenment, like
right,
no gravity in a weight room. You throw the weight and it just goes on for, oh, so I was trying to bench press and I just threw the whole gym's worth of weight and there it goes off into space. If it was that easy to ascend to enlightenment and get to those states, where's the choice? There's no choice at that point. Like,
right,
we create a system of equal opposing resistance, and then choice is our rudder that allows us to actually play a game that means something, that's enjoyable, that brings up these emotions, that allows us to experience something that is a difference than what we experience as a pure consciousness being. That's why. That is the meaning of life. That's
yes,
why we're here, to experience that, to renew that. That like an evergreen spring that's constantly recycling the water with oxygen, and we're using choice to get there. You know,
God,
that's
damn it. That moment when you remember that truth, because that thing you're talking about, I forget it. And actually, sometimes I'll be walking around in a really bad mood, and I'll think to myself, wait, what is it, the thing you always remember that you're forgetting? I'm like, you're forgetting it right now, that thing. And sometimes I can't remember it. And I'll be like, oh, I don't remember. Fuck it. This fucking shit day. But then sometimes I'll be like, oh, I forgot again. Oh, yeah, now I remember. In any single given moment, I can believe that this is paradise. I can make the decision that I am not just existing in paradise, but literally that thing from which paradise emerges into the universe that I happen to be in. And the moment you do that and you don't make it based on any emotional choice, it's wild, right? Everything
changes. It's wild.
It's like teleportation.
It's our superpower. It's our inherent superpower that we all have, is to control our internal environment. And people make these choices in the most extreme conditions. Like, everybody loves to talk about, but what if this situation? But what if this situation? I was reading a book by Ryan Holiday called, I forget the name of, what's the name of his most recent book? It's about Marcus Aurelius and whatever. It's drawing a blank on that. But anyways, the story in the book is that there was a prisoner of war, and the prisoner of war is in horrible conditions in Vietnam. People are dying around him. He's been there for years. He made a decision that every single day he was going to mentally play a game of golf on his favorite golf course.
Wow.
There. And that was his way of coping with it and creating an environment internally that allowed him to cope and survive. So he played that, and some days he'd get in the rough and he'd, you know, figure out how to get the, oh, I hit it in the water trap today. And, you know, you'd play and keep score. He eventually gets out. Most of the people he was with died. He eventually gets out. He goes back to his course. He plays that game of golf and he scores par on that golf course.
Wow.
Like in the fully documented story of that. So he took control of his own internal environment in the most hellacious external environment you could possibly imagine. And we all have that choice. And sometimes you can't just mental override from A to B. And one thing I've learned is like, sometimes you have to take the little steps, like take the baby steps, like a frog using lily pads to cross a river. So maybe it's, I'm in this shit mood. I could either indulge it, or maybe I go on my phone and I play that happier song that I actually like.
Right.
And it may be a little bit grating at first, but I'll play that song.
Right.
And then I'll think this slightly more positive thought. And maybe I'll do something nice for somebody.
That's cool.
You know, and then, okay, after I played the song and done something nice for somebody, sent an old friend a compliment or a, hey, how are you?
Yeah.
And then maybe you go from there to this next stage until eventually you've chosen your way out of your depression, out of your funk.
Right.
You know, and you wouldn't have been able to choose from A to Z, but by going through the alphabet and making these little choices, you've given your will and given your intent to choose your way out of it.
That's brilliant, man. Because what happens for me, like if I'm deep in a funk, yeah, I won't think like that. I'll be like, all right, I got to feel better than I've ever felt my whole life this very fucking second.
Mm-hmm.
Like you're going to, yeah, you're right. Little steps. It's like, you know, the other day, man, where was I? The other day, I just finished like this great weekend in Atlanta performing. It's a great weekend, but I woke up in the morning and I'm like, I started listening to Elliott Smith, and I'm like, feel myself darkening, and I'm listening, and I'm like, what the fuck are you doing, man? Like, why have you made a decision to like tune into this specific frequency of like heroin and like tragedy? You don't have to if you don't want to. Yeah, and then all you got to do is change the music, right?
Change music. That's step one, you know, and then next step two. I think really giving to somebody too is such a big step in that,
right?
Because it takes you out of that kind of myopic, inwardly focused mindset where you're just worried about yourself. Like, do something kind to somebody, some random person, like doesn't matter. Send a text, you know, compliment somebody, say something, or just give them a warm smile. You know, like the act of giving is one of the best ways to get that part out of you, connect you with, you know, the greater parts of yourself.
This is why, in a way, like I don't know why this keeps emerging, but again and again, a favorite blog post in the interwebs right now is why tipping is an evil system. And I mean, I get the logic why they think that, but then I think that if we remove the opportunity to tip people, I think we're like taking something away from people, which mm-hmm. is just this cool thing where it's like, you know, someone's working super hard in a very stressful job where maybe they're not getting a lot of money. I think there's something, it's like you always have this opportunity in there to just be like, here's like triple what totally. I paid for the lunch. And yeah. like, you like, in like, there's this cool opportunity there. Whereas in this world, the opportunity to help someone, if you really think about it, it's kind of elusive in a weird way. Like mm-hmm. you need to get kind of, maybe not for you because you've got a ton of employees and you live in you're the center of an entire cyclone of industry here. So I'm sure that there's always someone that you can help out a little bit. But I guess what I'm trying to say is when someone needs help, if you recognize that not as a inconvenience,
sure,
but as an angel showing up into your life being like, hey, here's a chance for you to do something fucking amazing, and to feel really good, then you'll be more likely to help. You know? No doubt.
And it's also, you have to be aware of the traps of this too, because I saw this in Africa, actually, when I was out there doing some work with some kids in the slums. We were teaching them martial arts, but there's so many people go to Africa to help. And I could tell the motivation of so many people there was to give these goods so that they felt they had this like Jesus feeling to their ego, you know, like, oh, I'm able to give this and you can worship me because I have these resources to give. Yeah. And I think people like, that's why, you know, in little gossip circles, people love when someone's going through, secretly they love when one of their friends is going through some hard shit.
Right.
Because it makes them feel better about themselves.
Right.
And after they're done comforting that person, they feel better because it's, and that's not real altruism. That's not real love.
No way.
That's positioning of the ego in this ego game of like, I'm superior now and I'll help you.
You owe me now.
I'll throw you the scraps from my table.
I shall give you my blessing, Surf.
Yeah, exactly. Like that. So you have to be wary of that and just genuine. That's where like striving for as close to genuine altruism.
Wait,
as
that's
possible.
The difference between God and the Godfather, right?
Right. Totally. Yeah, perfect.
I will do this for you, and one day I will come asking for a favor.
Yeah.
The other difference is, like, now I don't care. You can, because I live in a universe of infinite abundance. I happen to have all this shit around me, and I'm going to give some of it to you. And I don't even care. I literally don't care. There's nothing that you could do to repay this because I'm already getting way more than I deserve from a universe that consists of grace. And I'm just so lucky to even have atoms that are aware of themselves right now that like, no, like that's, you're not really going to do better than that.
Yeah.
You can't do better than that for me. That's really cool, man. And when someone's doing that with you, you can feel it.
Totally.
When someone's just giving and you're like, what the fuck are you doing? Like you? Yeah, just stay in my super nice apartment downtown Austin with an incredible view. No, just stay there. No, here are the keys. And like, I'm, that's something for this, that seems confusing. Aubrey's letting me stay at this badass, I hope I'm allowed to say that. It's a really cool pad in Austin. But, you know, because of my programming, if someone's doing really nice shit, the way I start being like, well, thank you. Thank you. You do understand how grateful I am to you, do you? And it's like awful. I'm sure it's awful to deal with. But like your reaction to it is so cool. You're like, yeah, whatever. No, it's no problem. Yeah. And you feel it and it's cool. I want to be like that, man. I want to be more like that because that's a really beautiful way to be. I don't want to be the head of some karmic Bank of America, like mm-hmm. a bank manager, because some people are like that with love, you know, some people are like that with giving. They're running a fucking bank and it's like they are completely aware of every single loan that they've given in the form of
withdrawals
some...
and deposits.
Yes!
They're keeping track of a ledger.
It's so gross.
It's almost demonic at that, to a certain level of that. There's such a base level of programming, and not that it's demonic to do. We've all go there, but it's the opposite of godhood. You know, it's the opposite of this unconditional. The sunlight shines on all things, regardless of who they are or where they are. It's just warmth and it's just light. You know, it's like, I think one of the coolest things that I've had a friend who's also one of my teachers say to me was, he says, Aubrey, you are always forgiven to me. Always. Before you even do anything. There's not anything that you could do that you are not pre-forgiven right now. You're always forgiven.
Wow.
And I just kind of like let that sit in. And it was this cool, like warm feeling because you never have to worry like, oh, I wonder if I said something that offended him or I wonder if maybe I did this. He's like, no. From now, forever, you're always forgiven. You know, and it's just like, that's a fucking cool thing to give somebody. And that's real love. That's, you know, altruism there.
Oh, God. And what a relief.
Yeah. What a relief, right?
For him. What a relief to pre-forgive.
Yeah, pre-forgive.
Just pre-forgive. Like, no matter what it is, I totally forgive you. Whatever the thing is, you're pre-forgiven from now until infinity. And then you don't have to worry about it because you know the opposite of forgiveness is vengeance, right?
Yep.
And so vengeance takes so much energy, right? Revenge is the most creepy, shitty thing that can happen. And it's such a weight. You know, if you're someone out there who wants to get revenge. I know. Do you know people who take revenge? I do.
Oh, totally.
Oh! And it's like they wait in the shadows to leap out at just the right time and say just the right thing. And then there are people who get revenge on the small scale, you know, like
I'll hear people who will relate in great detail the way they made the fucking Time Warner sales rep feel like shit for fucking up their bill. You know what I mean? Yeah. They'll relate like, oh, I got him good. I told him, do you know what I'm going to do to you? I don't know. Or Yelpers, right, for example. Right, Yelp sure. Yelp is a revenge application. Yelp is a way that assholes get revenge for bad service. That's what it is. You're not allowed to punch someone who gives you food that you don't like, but you can definitely try to fuck at their business. And a lot of people, if they could, would close a business down because their fucking steak wasn't medium rare.
Sure.
If they could, they would have whoever runs the business, their family thrown out on the street in the cold of Siberia, ruining the day that they left the fucking steak.
And you know why?
Why?
Because that's what they're doing to themselves on a daily fucking basis. They're taking that vulnerable inner part of themselves and they're playing the same revenge games. Everything that you see expressed internally, I guarantee, is done internally. We are generally kinder to the external world than we are to ourselves. So whatever you see externally portrayed, all of these vengeance, you can guarantee you can add a multiple, a delta, 5%, 10%, 50%, 100% worse that individual is doing it to themselves.
Oh, God damn it, man. There's the compassion, right?
Yeah.
That's where you get the saint-like compassion. That's where you get the compassion. Because when you hear about this is just on Nancy Grace. And she's like, lighten up this kid who he did a terrible thing. It's this video of this kid in a park and he knocks this woman out. He just cold cocks her. She's like, what? You think I won't hit you? You think I won't hit you? Then he hits her, knocks her out, and then gives a speech after knocking this woman out, the opposite of an inspirational speech where he's like, for all the bitches out there who just saw what I did, who think I won't hit you, no, I will hit you. That's his whole message to the world. So on one level, it's one of the most revolting things you've ever seen. You would love to see him drawn and quartered. You'd love to see the old canoe technique where you put him in the canoe with his legs out and honey's poured all over his body and maggots and ants slowly dissolve him on the shore of some tropical river. But But on the other side, if you go at it from what you're saying, and you realize that this guy, his life is hell.
Yep.
He's waking up in hell. He's going to bed in hell. And in between, he's in hell because he's hurting so fucking bad that he's gone beyond numb. And now he's just if he's punching women in the face in parks on a daily basis, he's probably just grinding himself to... Mm-hmm. Who knows what's happened in his life, right? Totally. I'm not saying that we have to allow that behavior to happen.
You have to stop it, but you also have to understand what's actually happening there. In a lot of Native American tribes, when something like that happens, there's equal compassion for the victim. In fact, more compassion for the perpetrator because they understand that the perpetrator of that thing is in more pain than the victim. The victim will recover faster than the perpetrator.
Wow.
Now, it doesn't mean you shouldn't do everything to prevent that and make sure that until this person can get enough spiritual, mental, psychic, physical rehab that they're not going to do that again.
Right.
You have to take precautions, but you rally to the perpetrator because you understand that that is a source of pain that's even deeper than that of the victim. Because the victim had something unjustly done and you have to help them get through that trauma. But the true source of the pain is coming from that perpetrator. Unless you fix that pain, that person's going to suffer forever. Whereas when the wounds heal, I get PTSD might happen, something like that, which is a big deal. But when the wounds heal from the victim, they still don't feel like they deserve it. So a lot of that internal pain isn't going to be there, Whereas with the victim, the perpetrator, that pain is going to be sitting and rotting and festering until that's treated.
That's one of the true revolutionary ideas there, man. That's one of the true revolutionary ideas is that we love those people and that we love them for real love, not punishing love, not condescending love. Oh, yeah. But it's so hard, man. We're not that advanced. I think that the technology that you have been utilizing... and it is a technology. When people hear that, some people are like, that's not a technology. Technology's my iPhone or the new Tesla. They don't understand. It's so weird that for some people, technology ends where, is only circuit boards and lasers.
Right.
They don't realize that there's
varying technologies all around this planet, and some of them are way older than computers, like a million, like a way more advanced. Like, imagine where we're going to be 20, 45, 100 years from now, from the technology that we currently have, the technology of circuitry.
It's a bias towards things you can touch,
right?
You know, it's like this bias of, like, a laser is not going to affect consciousness. You can't throw a rock at it and hit it. So when you're talking about a technology that's affecting your consciousness or affecting your thought patterns in certain ways, it can't be tangible. You know, it has to be something. Maybe it has a tangible source, but what it's generating is something that's intangible, and that's just as much a technology. It's
fuck
just
yeah.
You can't touch it.
Plants are a technology.
No doubt.
DNA is a technology. And mm-hmm. and these things are like, you know, to me, when I look at a DNA helix, or I look at the insane perfect balance that plants have with the earth, this perfect, incredible give and take that's happening, to me, that's the signature of God on the time space continuum. Mm-hmm. It's like this like incredible, like beautiful way of saying, yeah, this is what I'm like. I never heard that about the ascended masters incarnating as plants, man. That's that's so cool, real. Man. That's so right on.
Yeah.
But so this technology that you're talking about, man, this love technology, to me, if I had to pick between having an actual piece of alien technology, something from Roswell, one of those, like, supposedly they found, like, bits from the crash that, like, you could, like, bend them out of shape and they'd form right back into the shape that they were.
Like a slap bracelet, but on steroids.
Exactly. Exactly. If I had a choice between having one of those from Roswell or having a rose inside of me that allowed me to somehow love even the most vile people, or maybe not even the most vile, but just the most annoying, or even not the most annoying, but just people I actually love now, but in this way that you're talking about, I'd pick the latter in a second.
No doubt.
That's way more useful and way more incredible than a UFO landing on the planet. Because if that shit spreads, man, you know, alien technology spreads in sci-fi movies and there's havoc and chaos, you know?
Right.
But if this love technology that you're talking about contaminates our ecosystem in the same way we're worried about contaminating the ice caps of Mars with our viruses. Mm-hmm. If this love technology contaminates this planet, what are things going to look like, Aubrey? What would the planet look like?
There's a book called The Fifth Sacred Thing, which is a good example of what a little world like could look like. It has a contrast between a utopia and a dystopia. But I recommend that to people who are exploring that question, because that's a cool fucking question. One of my favorites. So there's two books. Aldous Huxley wrote a book called Island, and this woman, Starhawk, wrote a book called Fifth Sacred Thing.
Okay.
And it explores what that world looks like. And it's fucking cool, man. It's just, it rewrites so many of these rules that we take for granted, you know, and it's what ultimately the ideal that Para El Bien de Todos is working towards. It's like, that's possible. It's totally possible. You know, a lot of shit needs to change. A lot of things need to happen, but we can incrementally get closer and closer to that. And we're doing it already. Like, the way that these draconian laws around marijuana are unraveling, and medical research is going on in psilocybin and ayahuasca and religious freedoms for these different medicines, and the way that we're, you know, now finally pulling down these racist flags from the southern part of America. Like, all of these things are starting to happen. People are identifying with spiritual practices, and it's happening. Like, it's here. It's coming. What that looks like, you know, that's still the work of fiction and imagination, but it's a fun practice to go and do.
You're one of the people making that happen, Aubrey. I'm so happy we're friends. Thank you so much for being on this podcast.
Man.
You're the coolest ever. Hare Krishna.
Much love, everybody.
Thanks for listening, everybody. This episode was brought to you by Squarespace.com. Go to Squarespace and use offer code Duncan to receive 10% off your first order. We're also brought to you by the Zen Float Company. Go to ZenFloatCo.com. Use offer code FAMILYHOUR to get $50 off your badass brand new float tank. Thanks for all of you for using and bookmarking our Amazon portal. And most importantly, thank you for listening.
This week, do me a favor and try to not blow up any kids. Rub your dog, rub yourself. I'll see you soon. Hare Krishna.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
You have 5 new messages.
Hey, Carl, it's Jen from Finance. Could you submit your expenses this week?
Hey, Carl, happy Friday. It's Jen, Finance. Just need those receipts today.
Me again, Carl. Really need those receipts, like last week. Please just tell me where they are. Are you by your desk right now?
Finance teams, you shouldn't be chasing down Carl or anyone else. With Ramp, expenses are sent with a text and reminders happen automatically. Switch your business to ramp.com today and love finance again.